Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Become apparent with this stop work order that it could extend into years.
The last remaining private company with a lease to drill in Anwar has pulled out. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 22nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, local opposition builds against Donlin Gold's proposed mine.
We have a livelihood and it's fully based around the things that are naturally provided to us, and it's just very much worth saving.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area. And dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Former State Representative Dean Westlake's son is charged with beating Westlake to death Saturday morning in Anchorage. 36-year-old Talon Westlake faces charges of manslaughter and evidence tampering in the death of his 62-year-old father, Dean, who served in the Alaska House of Representatives from January to December 2017. Early indications are that the father and son had fought over a rental dispute related to the South Anchorage apartment where Dean Westlake died. According to a charging document, Talon called 911 a little before 7 a.m. Saturday, asking for an ambulance for his dad, who he said was unconscious and not breathing. The charges say detectives found blood on the walls and floor, and Dean looked like he'd been pummeled. Talon refused to talk, but the detective saw what appeared to be blood on his hands, and his right hand seemed to be swollen, the charges say. According to the charges, Dean's girlfriend, who was out of town, owned the building. She told detectives that Talon had been living in the apartment, but had not paid rent in 4 months, so Dean had planned to evict him. She also told them Dean had recently had his hip replaced and was on blood thinners due to an issue with his heart. The detectives also talked to a neighbor who'd heard loud arguing sometime around 2 or 2:30 a.m. Saturday. Court records show Talon Westlake jailed in Anchorage on $50,000 cash bail. Dean Westlake was a Democrat who represented Alaska's North Slope and Northwest Arctic in State House District 40. He resigned in December 2017 after multiple women accused him of sexual harassment and, according to the Anchorage Daily News, reports that he had fathered a child with a 16-year-old when he was 28. The last remaining private company that bid in last year's controversial Arctic National Wildlife Refuge lease sale has pulled out of its lease. It's another blow for drilling advocates hoping to develop the northernmost slice of the refuge in northeast Alaska. Environmental groups celebrated the news today. Knik Arm Services was one of just two small companies that each picked up a single tract in the last-minute lease sale the Trump administration arranged in January 2021, days before leaving office. The other company canceled its lease a few months ago. The only other bidder was the state-owned Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, which picked up 7 tracts. Knik Arm Services owner Mark Graber says it no longer felt worth it to hold on to the lease amid the legal battles. President Joe Biden has suspended the leases while the Interior Department conducts an environmental review. ADA has sued.
Well, it's become apparent with this stop work order that it could extend into years, especially assuming ADA's lawsuit drags on indefinitely. So it was just time to move on to better opportunities.
Graber says Knik Arm Services put in about $2.1 million for the tract. He says the Bureau of Land Management has accepted a request to terminate the lease and will issue a full refund. BLM has not yet replied to a request for comment. The refuge has been the subject of significant controversy for decades. Indigenous groups, including Gwich'in communities, have long fought against developing the Arctic coastal plain for drilling because it is a calving ground for caribou, a subsistence animal. Environmental activists argue that expanding fossil fuel development will worsen the impacts of climate change. Donlin Gold will soon face a final business decision on whether or not to start construction of their proposed mine near Crooked Creek. In the face of growing regional resistance to the mine, the company hosted a tour of the site as part of what they call an emphasis on transparency. KYUK's William McCarthy has more on that visit.
So thanks for welcome to Donlin.
After promising drilling results over the past year, Donlin is now moving toward an updated feasibility study for their mine. The next step after that would be to begin construction, which requires a $6 billion investment. Although the recent drilling has helped prove the value of the gold deposit, the mine has also faced a series of lawsuits and growing community opposition. Donlin and Calista hope that informational tours like this one can help ease people's concerns and temper that resistance. Here's Dan Graham, the mine's general manager.
So again, this is a safe and environmentally sound mine. A lot of the discourse on the project centers around what I call a false premise of an either-or proposition. Either you can have the mine and you're going to lose your way of life, or you can preserve your river and way of life, but you can't do that with a mine. To me, that's just false messaging for the project.
The Donlin Gold Mine has been in the works for nearly 30 years, after the mine site area was selected by Calista Native Corporation during the Alaska Native Claims Settlement. Calista owns the subsurface mineral rights, and the nearby Village Corporation owns the land that the mine would operate on. Both of these corporations back the Donlin project. For a time, many communities downriver did too. But over the past 10 years, a growing number of tribes and villages in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have raised concerns over the project's environmental impacts. In 2019, the Association of Village Council Presidents representing 56 tribes in the YK Delta passed a resolution opposing the mine, reversing a stance they had held since 2006. Calista maintains that the majority of their shareholders still support the project. Here's Tom Leonard, Calista's Vice President of Corporate Affairs.
As permits have been earned, things got a little bit more real. I think there it's natural that there's more concerns and fears that come into play. You're talking about emotions, and emotions aren't something you can argue with.
Leonard says that the main thing shareholders want is more jobs and training opportunities for themselves and their family members. Donlin says they hire local people and shareholders as much as possible and currently claim a 70% shareholder hire rate. 60% of Calista's shareholders live in the YK Delta, and the mine would employ 3,000 people during construction and 1,000 thereafter. Still, at least for one Calista shareholder, Sophie Swope, all the talk of jobs feels like a big bait and switch. Swope was not on the tour.
Calista said, "It gives us hope for jobs." And, you know, that kind of rubs me the wrong way, because here we are in Bethel with YKHC, our regional health corporation. They have over 300 job openings. So there are plenty of jobs to be filled. We just need to get people the education to do that.
Swope is the director of Mother Kuskokwim, a grassroots organization that opposes the Donlin mine. To Swope, Calista's mission should not be to force controversial projects on their shareholders. Swope says that there are serious concerns that the mine would destroy two salmon spawning tributaries, increase the amount of mercury deposited into the water, and create a tailings dam that holds toxic mining waste which would have to be maintained in perpetuity. Corporate interests and tribal interests seem at odds in this native-owned project.
We are very different from any other tribes in the country, being in Alaska, because we have the native corporations and they are for-profit. So we're kind of put into this westernized state of mind and what we're supposed to be doing with our lands.
The Mother Kuskokwim organization is circulating a petition opposing the mine and trying to gather shareholders representing 10% of Calista's shares. If they're able to build that support, Calista will have to decide whether or not to hold a special meeting on proceeding with the mine, although they're not obligated to. Opposition has also come from the environmental law firm Earth Justice, which has filed numerous lawsuits against Donlin on behalf of 13 tribes in the Delta. These lawsuits oppose a natural gas pipeline that would provide energy for the mine and allege that the project would violate state and federal water quality standards. Those lawsuits argue that the mine poses an existential threat to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. I asked Christina Woolston, Donlin Gold's external affairs manager, if those lawsuits had impeded the mine's development timeline.
No, I mean, frankly, it's part of the opposition process. It's kind of what we see all over the world with organizations coming from the outside and opposing a project.
Still, any of these lawsuits could delay, if not derail, the project and potentially make it less attractive for investors. Enrique Fernandez, the mine's environmental program manager, thinks opposition to the mine is less likely to grow if people are better informed about the safety measures and water monitoring they have in place. In his view, the mine would be a huge boon for the YK Delta.
This is not just a job. It's something you want to see built. And this is one of the most, you know, economically depressed areas in the U.S. And I know what a game change this could be for this region.
But to Mother Kuskokwim Sophie Swope, who grew up here and wants to build her life around the future of the river, that strategy for uplifting the region just isn't worth the risk.
There's so much more that we can do other than mining gold. The Yupik culture, we have kind of our pre-Westernized attachment to the earth. And I feel like going in and pulling away the earth is just such a big disruption to everything that we have had for centuries. We have a livelihood and it's fully based around the things that are naturally provided to us. And it's just very much worth saving.
In Bethel, I'm Will McCarthy.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the unusual bet that motivated a Bristol Bay High School student to graduate.
I let him know that if the entire senior class graduated this year, that he could have the honor of shaving my head.
That head shave is coming up. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Alaska's potential to provide critical minerals is the focus of a two-day meeting that got underway this morning at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Critical minerals, including copper, lithium, nickel, cobalt, and rare earth elements that are used in a range of technologies, including electric vehicles. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan opened the event with a discussion of opportunities and roadblocks the state faces in developing critical minerals. Many of those minerals currently come from China, a country Sullivan says has become much more of a threat than it was 10 years ago. He says national security officials understand what's at stake and laid blame on the Biden administration for a disconnect that's hampering development of critical minerals, like stopping the Ambler Industrial Access Road.
The same day, the President of the United States held a critical minerals summit at the White House. The Department of Interior reversed the record of decision on the Ambler mining decision. You had a seven-year EIS, cost $10 million, thousands and thousands of people weighed in, and the Biden administration reversed that. Okay? That is not progress.
Sullivan also took aim at a new Biden administration National Environmental Policy Act rule he says will slow down permitting for development projects. Senator Murkowski reflected on the role cell phones and other technology play in our lives and described the need for critical minerals as a nonpartisan issue.
I think there is clearly a greater appreciation that this country has got to get in the game when it comes to critical minerals.
Murkowski added that Alaska's potential to safely fulfill domestic demand for critical minerals is not appreciated outside the state.
They don't believe that we will protect our environment. They think that we are too willing to rape, pillage, and ruin for our own benefit.
Murkowski says it's up to Alaskans to demonstrate high environmental standards and best development practices. The Critical Minerals Summit at UAF is being put on in partnership with the Wilson Center and U.S. Arctic Research Commission, and includes presentations from industry, Alaska Native corporations, state and federal agencies, science and research representatives. Governor Mike Dunleavy is scheduled to address the summit tomorrow morning. Oil and gas company Marathon Petroleum says global instability is complicating its plans on the Kenai Peninsula. It's still aiming to turn a decades-old liquefied natural gas export plant there into an import facility so it can bring in fuel for its crude oil refinery down the road. But it wants more time. Federal regulators granted a project extension last week, pushing the project deadline back to 2025. The company says the future of the project will hinge on whether it can find a competitive fuel source, which in today's market is looking more challenging than ever. KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports.
Jason Fear is the global head of business at a Houston-based intelligence firm. He says Marathon isn't the only business looking for cost-competitive natural gas right now. The war in Ukraine has created an unexpectedly high demand for it overseas.
That has pushed prices up very high.
And that complicates Marathon's plans to start importing gas to the facility near Nikiski. The facility was previously an exporter of liquefied natural gas. And for 5 decades, it was the only one in North America. But as the global natural gas market became more competitive, then-owner ConocoPhillips mothballed the facility, and Marathon took over ownership in 2018. A year later, Marathon subsidiary Trans-Forland Pipeline applied to turn the export facility into an import one. Federal regulators told the company it had until December 2022 to do so. But in a filing last month, it told regulators it doesn't expect to finish the project by then, quote, despite good faith efforts to do so. And it said the global instability from the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine have given the company pause in making a decision about the project and its fuel supply source. Fear says that instability is driven by increases in Europe's demand for LNG as Russian suppliers cut back.
So you would think the next few years are going to see some pretty high LNG prices that would, you know, make sort of new entrants into the LNG market really think twice about whether it's competitive. And they would really have to sort of dig into the details of how they're going to use it, how much it's going to cost.
The natural gas would likely be a source of fuel for Marathon's own crude oil refinery down the street. But now it's a question of where the company will get the gas from and whether it can get it at an affordable price. And Fear says it might take 3 or 4 years at least for producers in the U.S. to build up the capacity to meet the high global demand. Still, the company says it's confident the project is still commercially viable, and Fear says it wouldn't be too big of a lift for Marathon to convert the facility from an export to an import one, since it already has a lot of the tanks and jetties that it would need in place.
So this isn't a huge stretch.
That said, he says those costs aren't inconsequential. And he says companies will first want to make sure they can recover their investments before they pump any money into a new project. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Ketchikan welcomed a new U.S. Coast Guard cutter on Friday. KRBD's Eric Stone went down to Ketchikan's cruise ship docks to watch the 154-foot Douglas Denman sail in.
The new fast-response cutter Douglas Denman steamed down Ketchikan's Tongass Narrows on a blue sky day, led by a 45-foot response boat from the local Coast Guard station. Executive Petty Officer Coleman Aldrich brought the whole family out to the downtown cruise ship docks to watch the new boat come in. He says it's not just a homecoming for the cutter. Crew members from Ketchikan have been working on the boat, running drills and training since March.
It's really cool for me to stand here on the pier and welcome another crew in, knowing that all the trials and tribulations they've been through and you know, all the hectic days, long hours that they've put in. So it's really very rewarding to see all that come to a close and just be like, hey, we made it home. Everybody's safe. The cutter's safe. And we can see our families again.
He says the crew picked up the cutter in Louisiana, took it to Key West for outfitting, and then sailed through the Panama Canal and up the West Coast to its new home port.
It's a pretty significant event. So, yeah, I know the guys are really, really excited to be home.
Allie Olson says she was glad to see her husband, a bosun's mate first class, assigned to the Douglas Denman after a long time away.
It's very exciting. It's really cool to see how the crew has gotten to know each other and how they've built their workforce. And the families here in Ketchikan are also very supportive and tight-knit. And we're all very excited to have them home.
The Douglas Denman will stay in Ketchikan temporarily while port facilities in Sitka are under construction. It'll be the third fast response cutter in Ketchikan for the time being, joining the Bailey Barco and the John McCormick. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Parents and child care providers in Sitka may be reaching a breaking point, as data suggests that families are leaving or choosing not to come because of the lack of adequate child care. Sitka's population of children under 13 has dropped by a staggering number in the last decade. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports on findings from Sitka Tribe of Alaska's recent child care study presented at Harrigan Centennial Hall.
For at least a decade, the Sitka Tribe of Alaska has provided assistance to tribal citizens with children in licensed childcare and directed federal funds to providers through a Child Care and Development Fund block grant. Melanie Board is the director of social services at the tribe.
Once the pandemic hit, the number of tribal children attending licensed care plummeted. So we were kind of at a loss. What do we do?
At the same time, the tribe received an additional funding boost through the American Rescue Plan. So they used some of the extra money to commission an in-depth study examining child care needs and gaps in Sitka. What the study found supports what many parents and child care providers have been saying over the last few years. It's the perfect storm. Even with 8 licensed facilities in Sitka, child care remains expensive and difficult to access. Most of the facilities are operating at around half capacity, and the main reason these child care providers can't fully open up is staffing. That leaves families without options and providers struggling to keep their doors open. Iris Matthews leads the Stellar Group, the research and consulting firm that conducted the study.
The wait list is over 100 long, and that's probably not everybody looking for care because a lot of people just heard they called. They didn't even bother to put their name on the list because they're going to be number 49, number 50, and they need care now.
If a child can get in the door, the cost is high for parents, around 16% higher than the state average. And it's high for providers, too.
You know, none of them are getting rich on these rates either. As challenging as it can be for families to pay for care, that is the great balancing act that comes out too, is that it's really hard work for providers, too.
There are resources to support the cost of childcare, both provided by the state and the tribe. But Matthews says enrollment in those programs isn't high.
Fewer than 44 are probably accessing any form of childcare assistance. That's not very many for all those kids right now.
Sitka isn't the only community in Alaska that's experiencing childcare woes. Matthews says it's caused enough economic disruption that the business community is paying closer attention. The Alaska Chamber of Commerce published its own research on childcare last year.
That chamber survey found that 77% of parents have missed work because of childcare issues, and they equated it to about $165 million in lost productivity for our economy. So it's definitely an impact.
All of this may be affecting a family's decision to have children. Sitka has about 800 fewer residents in 2021 than in 2011, but that population dip is largest among young children.
The population of Sitka declined by just under 10%, but the population of children 0 to 12 was down by 29%. We don't really know why that is. One thing we do know is that Sitka has a fairly low birth rate compared to other parts of the state.
She said there's speculation that this decrease could be tied to the high cost of living in Sitka and the availability and cost of childcare. The majority of survey respondents in the tribe study cited the high cost of housing and basic needs in Sitka as the number one challenge to raising children here. Number two, a hard time finding childcare. Matthews says advocacy at the state level is a crucial next step, but at the local level, Melanie Board says the Sitka tribe is making moves.
Well, I wish we could say that we have all the answers, but we don't. But we have started to think about strategic planning.
Lord said the tribe is developing its strategic plan to address the childcare shortage. Although it isn't set in stone yet, it provides around $400,000 toward programs like mini grants for existing childcare providers to build capacity and to provide financial support for in-home and relative care. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
As school starts in classrooms across Bristol Bay, students are getting to work. Each homework assignment, essay, and quiz a step toward earning their diplomas. Last year, a local principal made an unusual bet with a student to help motivate him to graduate. KDLG's Izzy Ross has the story of a senior who put in the work to get his diploma and shave his principal's head.
Shannon Harvilla is the principal and assistant superintendent of the Bristol Bay Borough School District, which has around 100 students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Last year, he received a surprising request from a student.
Junior Torino approached me at the beginning of the school year, semi-joking, you know, because I had long hair, if he could shave it.
Harvilla took Torino up on the bet.
I let him know that if the entire senior class graduated this year, that he could have the honor of shaving my head.
Sinan Torino, also called Junior, says he had a rough start to the school year.
I was, like, pretty short on credits, and so didn't think I was going to graduate, but midway through the year, I started cranking out some more classes than I needed.
Torino says his bet with Principal Harvilla motivated him to persevere through some tough parts of 12th grade.
Oh yeah, it pushed me a little bit more. I really wanted to see him bald, so it was really stressful. I had some doubts, but I didn't let that stop me from anything. I knew that he would stick to his word. I didn't expect a lot of the kids to come down and watch, but it was fun. I'm glad I got to do it in front of everybody, and everyone got a chance to see.
Torino graduated last spring along with 10 of his classmates. The students celebrated with the rest of the community. Harvilla says it was the first real in-person event the school hosted since the start of the pandemic 2 years earlier. And Torino spoke at graduation. He says he was nervous.
I was one of the class speakers, so I had to talk about my whole class in front of everybody at graduation, so I was kind of nervous, but once I got up there, it was fun. There's definitely been some good times with them, and it's going to be different, but everyone's going to go their separate ways, and maybe we'll stay connected somehow.
Afterward, he made one last trip to school to shave Harvilla's head in front of the student body. Harvilla says it was worth it.
I knew that he would have to put in extra work in order to graduate, and I knew that any bit of motivation we could provide as adults would help him get to his goal of graduating.
Now Torino's working at the Borough Dock. The Borough's 2022 school year starts this week. No word yet on what Harvilla plans to do if all the seniors graduate this spring. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, William McCarthy in Bethel, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Catherine Rose in Sitka, and Izzy Ross in Dillingham. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.